1053 Main Street Gallery is located in the historic, renovated Fleischmann's Telephone Building. Open Friday and Saturday from 11 to 5, Sunday from 12 to 4, and by appointment. Information about 1053 Main Street Gallery and Fleischmann's and upcoming exhibitions at 1053maingallery.com. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center in Walton. Open 7:30 to 2:30, Tuesday through Saturday, for waste disposal and recycling. In service to make a difference by reducing pollution in Delaware County. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center, State Route 10 in Walton, 607-832-5800. Or click the Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center link at WIOXradio.org.
This is Dan O'Connell, host of Monday Morning Music on WIOX Roxbury. As a WIOX spokesperson, I also manage underwriting for the station, and I'm here to let you know that underwriting on WIOX is a great way to support the station and inform the community about your business or service. If you'd like to become an underwriter, contact me for details at 607-326-3900 or WIOX at WIOXradio.org.
Listening to WIOX Community Radio live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org on computers or smartphones. This is From the Forest every Wednesday with Ryan and John. Talk about a different forest-related topic. How's it going, John?
Oh, it's going good, Ryan. What's up?
Well, I think the maple sugaring season might be ending in a large portion of the Catskill Mountains that are at least lower elevation, but you were telling me that even up here in Roxbury and Delaware County, the forecast is looking pretty warm.
Yeah, my local weather report in Delhi shows a couple nights that are close to freezing, but not quite, 33 or 34. But that's it. No more freezing nights in the two-week forecast, minus tomorrow night.
Yeah. You know, the season wasn't that bad. I tapped, I think, mid-January, so it's been a while. I'm ready to be done. But central Ulster County, where I live, just under 1,000 feet, it's warm. So, yeah, tomorrow's going to be cold, and then that's it. We're very warm after that.
Yeah, so one more run. We'll see. Hopefully the commercial guys made everything they needed, but who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know. I mean, I'm gonna not be that bad. I'm kind of jaded, though, because I tapped my two best trees. I didn't tap all of them this year. And I'm going to be just under half a gallon per tap, I think, when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
At the end of the weekend.
Right.
Which is great, but it's also my two best trees, so
yeah.
Who knows?
That matters.
That matters a lot. I mean, heck, the one bucket, it's just been constantly overflowing. I've lost a lot.
Yeah.
This one tree just won't stop running.
Yeah, I think I don't know. It might be if I get to point three, that would be amazing. But I don't know. We'll see. Could happen. So usually I make about 0.4 to a half a gallon per tap. So that is what it is. And but I can't complain. I got more syrup than I had before. And I don't know. Last night I made some, and it was actually very good quality. I was surprised, despite how warm it is. But when it gets up in the 50s, even if it does freeze the night before, I don't know, that sap, usually not the best quality. So, anyway. Well, tonight's topic is Omar Stewart's Forgotten Fires. And I thought we had to talk about this because this is a book written in the 1950s, I believe, or so. And it's about, you know, the importance or really the relevance of indigenous or Native American fires across North America. So he talks about the Northeast a little bit, Southeast, Rocky Mountain, Pacific Northwest, California has its own chapter, and then the prairie provinces of Canada, stuff like that. And Omar Stewart was an author, but he was born in 1908, so we're going way back.
Okay.
He died in 1991. He's a cultural anthropologist and author at the University of Colorado at Boulder, which I went to back in 2000 for a year. So that's cool. He retired in 1973, and he defended Native American land claims and advocated for tribes' legal use of peyote, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah?
But he was, I think he only lost one or two court cases out of 16 to 20 or so, I forget what it was, of land claims. So he was successful in that.
Cool.
But this book, I found out about it when I read another book called Ignition by Maura O'Connor.
Who was on this show recently.
Yeah, who was on this radio show. And she talks about her experiences as a wildland firefighter. She was a journalist, or an author rather, in order to get to know fire and how it's fought and the culture and everything surrounding it. She took the S-130, S-190, basic wildland firefighting, and became a firefighter and ended up really liking it. You can tell that from reading her book. And but she mentions Omar Stewart in that book, and I was like, man, I never even heard of it. So sometimes that's how I find out about books, just people keep referencing something and, go to the root of it. But this guy was like a pioneer. I mean, you read books today about this about the importance of fire, and fire was way more prevalent than we ever thought. You know, when we had Charles Mann, who wrote 1491, and then the second book, 1493, he talks about, well, there's probably way more Native Americans than we ever thought, and they had a lot more influence over our forest and the environment, and mainly that was through fire. We had Charles Pine on. I think that's his first name. Pine, I mean, he's the guy who writes about fire all the time. University of Arizona. He wrote Fire in America, World Fire. World Fire is a great book, and talks about how in order to be human, really, it's to know fire. You know, everything about humans is fire, whether it's combustion engine or open woods burning. And to him, he thinks it's a shame that, you know, open woods burning has gone down. He talks about Native Americans. But Omar Stewart precedes all these people.
Okay.
And, you know, for a long time, there was kind of a battle, I think Stephen Pine talks about this, but you know, in the early 20th century, 1930s, there was a cultural or academic war between the light burners. People wanted to burn a little bit, right? And the people who wanted to suppress fires. I'm sad to say the foresters, for the most part, were totally against fire for the most part. A lot of them were all about ruining the timber, you know? Mm-hmm. So we got to suppress all these fires. They came up with the 10 a.m. policy. We've talked about this on the radio show before. Gus Kilcox, USDA, Forest Service, or whatever it was called back then, came up with that 10 a.m. policy. The fire has to be out by 10 o'clock the next day. And they were very successful in it. The light burners were like, you got to burn a little bit. Otherwise, you end up getting fuels and big fires.
Mm-hmm.
Sound familiar?
We hear a lot about that right now, right?
The light burners lost the cultural war. To me, the light burners are in the conservationist camp, really. In a weird way, the foresters, to me, at that time, they're almost in the preservation camp. It's like, really, never fire ever? I mean, they sound like preservationists of today. Never cut? No, never cut?
Right.
The foresters believe in cutting, but they were like, never burning? Really? I mean, you're really going to support this?
You know,
I don't know.
Do you know it's why they picked 10 a.m. and where that came from, other than just got to have it out? Because is there any known context behind that?
I don't know. I mean, you know that at night the humidity goes up.
That's what I was thinking. That's what I was getting at. So, you know, usually what we learned when we took the S-130 at 190, you know, midday is when your relative humidity is really going to be dropping and that fire is going to pick back up again. Fire behavior is going to intensify. So 10 a.m., I guess, makes sense if you were trying to fight a big fire. But,
yeah,
where you're coming from, all fires?
All fires.
Right.
Gifford Pinchot may have been in that camp of foresters. He's the father of forestry who just never wanted to see a fire. Maybe. I'm not totally sure, but I think so. And it's too bad. We really are reaping the consequences of that right now. We had fire suppression for the majority of the latter part of the 20th century. Building fuels. In the Northeast, we don't feel fires as much just because of our abundant rainfall and certain tree species that kind of retard fires. But California doesn't have that.
Right.
They have heat and dry and all of that. And in his book, like they talk about, he says even back then, you know, you get a big fire and if the fire's too big, you end up getting erosion and mudslides afterwards. I'm like, Jesus Christ, I've been hearing that my whole life in California.
Mm-hmm.
About how, because it would burn so hot, it would actually take away the plant vegetation. And then if it's followed by any kind of rain or whatever, there goes all your soil. This guy was saying this in the 40s and 50s. All right? No one listened. He was an outlier. And really, you and our thinking, because the Omar Stewarts really lost the culture battle, a lot of our training is because of people like Clements, the ecologist, you know, that succession, climax ecology, which isn't as popular as it used to be, but it's still there. The way we're trained is plants are there because mostly of climate, because of soils, because of the hardiness and growing conditions. We didn't learn about fire. Mm-hmm. We don't learn about, well, actually, culture matters maybe more. And that's what Omar Stewart's book is about. His book isn't just based on his opinion. He says his opinion's in it. But it has tons of evidence. It's really based on evidence, research, and even huge demonstrations he did in the plains.
Of burning?
Of planting trees, because they said trees couldn't grow in the plains.
Uh-huh.
Right? Why was it plains? So I'm going to get into that tonight. If you're just tuning in, this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Omar Stewart's Forgotten Fires. Great book. Highly recommend it. Should be required reading for every natural resources student. Definitely forestry students. Anyone really pursuing natural resources. This book needs to be more widely covered, and I wish he was alive today so I could interview him. So, Forgotten Fires, Native Americans and the Transient Wilderness is basically the full title. That is the full title. And because this book wasn't as popular, I think this is why we think of pre-settlement as wilderness. We just think, you know, it's just a bunch of maybe five Native Americans running around, having very little impact. The prairies are where they are because climate, right? They get less rainfall, 17 inches to 30 inches, that produces prairies, right? Has to be so. It's got to be. Mesquites in California, why is it there? It's climate.
That's the convenient thought process, right?
Right. You look into the New York State, you know, you get a little more rainfall, more trees, right? That's what happens. We get trees, and it's a northern hardwood forest. Northern hardwoods are where they are totally because of rainfall and site conditions. And oak, well, that's more of a southern species, right? And so on and so forth. But is that true? Is that really true? So The book was based on research, 1950s and before. I mean, he goes back into the 1890s and 80s and covers each area of the United States, as I said before. The Northeast is really interesting to me for obvious reasons. Northeast is very complicated. I mean, we just have so many damn forest types.
Mm-hmm.
But there was even prairies in the Northeast.
Amazing.
Amazing. All right, so assumptions. Let's talk about what we assume today, and these assumptions are still, I would say, they are the paradigm in the environmentalism today. They're assumed to be true, but I never like to assume stuff is true. I'm a skeptic. I'm a forever skeptic, so there, take that. So I found out about Omar Stewart, again, from author Maura O'Connor's book Ignition, and in it she quotes, "Omar particularly regretted that his own peers, anthropologists, ignored evidence that indigenous people were powerful agents who had transformed the physical world." All right? Instead, now that's unquote. Instead, environmentalism is inundated with the myth of wilderness before European settlement.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, go ahead.
Today, I mean, that's all you ever hear about, right?
Yeah, I mean, geez, you know, I was taught, right? You've heard this, that a gray squirrel could jump from what? You're like,
yeah, I'm rolling my eyes through the microphone. Yeah, a gray squirrel could jump from wherever, all the way across America or whatever it is.
I think that's complete nonsense.
Absolutely, I really do.
I don't believe that for a second. Not even for a second.
I agree.
You know, so yeah, we look at it as though the whole east of the Mississippi was just like the last of the Mohicans running through cathedral pine forests. Well, what would they eat, by the way? People would be dead.
I know.
Starving to death. Yeah, they have different age classes of human beings, you know? Like, what would they eat, right? So I don't know. Instead, environmentalism is inundated with the myth of wilderness before European settlement. Site conditions are assumed to dictate the plants we find, right? So as the settlers start going west of Kentucky, they start seeing these big plains, right? And even before, western New York was big prairies, supposedly. But, right, they see these prairies, and how did they get there? It has to be naturally occurring.
Right.
Right? But is it? So precipitation, evaporation, temperature. Clemens, who's like pretty much... Yeah, American plant ecologist and pioneer in plant ecology is Frederick Clemens. He lived from 1874 to 1945. So just as his life is ending, Omar Stewart is really full bore into his writing right now. And he's questioning Clemens. And Clemens is like citing, you know, prairies all over the place, saying, yeah, fire had a little thing, and saying, like, yeah, after a fire in, say, Iowa, it would come back prairies, but you know, it's mainly due to precipitation. Mainly due to precipitation. And you know, it's all about succession, and fire has a little bit here and there, and there's lightning fires, and he goes into that too. Omar Stewart, you know, says it's not nearly as much as lightning. Lightning doesn't happen everywhere. It doesn't happen repeatedly, and it doesn't burn acreage repeatedly enough. Like fires were found across the United States consistently. But anyway, we got to talk about Clemens. He developed one of the most influential theories of vegetation development. And just stop me if this sounds familiar to you. So he suggested that development of vegetation is a unidirectional sequence of stages resembling the development of an individual organism. After disturbance, vegetation grows back towards a stable climax state, which describes the vegetation best suited to the local conditions. And vegetation is interpreted in relation to that sequence as a deviation from it due to non-ideal conditions. It's just all about sight.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I got into this not an argument, but I was talking to a forester, much more experienced than I am. He's been doing forestry for almost as long as I've been alive, or half my life, rather. And he just said, I asked him about white oak in the West Branch, Delaware. You know, have you ever seen white oak? Because it's pretty rare over there.
I know of two sites.
Yeah, he said, yeah. But, you know, it's on the dryer sites or whatever. And I was like, do you think Native Americans anything had to do with it? He got mad. He was like, no, absolutely not, you know. And I was like, well, what? Why do you think not? I mean, because I mean, we have a lot more white oak in the Esopus. And, you know, why is it more there than in the West Branch? You know, I don't know. But he's like, well, if there was any influence by Native Americans, it was cleared for agriculture. So that erased any of the past.
Okay. So the site's just over.
Which does make, you know, I can see how that could, you could think that. I mean, it was cleared highly. I mean, right? The average maximum pasture, according to Dr. Michael Kudish, forest historian, is what, 2,300 feet. Right.
The higher, I think he says 24 to 27.
Oh, yeah, the average maximum, right. Begins at that, right. Goes up to 27, is that it?
Something like that.
Something like that. Pretty high. It includes most of where people are in Delaware County, okay?
Absolutely. It's higher than your average house at this point, right?
Yeah, it's very rare that people live above 2,500 feet in the Catskill Mountains. I can think of a few places. So... All right, it's cleared, but how come they didn't all come back the same vegetation then? You know? Some areas came back with oak, hickory, chestnut, and some areas didn't. And I don't think it's any accident that the areas that are nearest to the largest valleys came back with oak, hickory, and chestnut. The Esopus, I mean, similar elevation in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Full of oak, hickory, chestnut. And then on, you know, on the Delaware, whenever you approach a large valley, you'll find more of that pyrogenic plants on a similar site that's further away from the valley. So that's what I don't get, right?
Right.
Why are some areas similar land use history as far as agriculture in the last, you know, 200 years, and then some areas don't. What was going on before that?
Right. So, like, in my area, I mean, I grew up in that West Branch Valley that you're talking about. As soon as you go north, you get into, like, Treadwell, and you leave the watershed, and you're in this, you know, the Susquehanna now. You find it again. You could find chestnut sprouts readily, white oak. Yeah. White pine comes back. But, again, you move south into Stanford, Hobart, Delhi, Courtright, all that area. Rare, very rare. You find individual stems. You never find forest types, though.
Right. Yeah, totally. So, you know, it's not, yeah, they cleared everything, but there's still seed sources on those really craggy areas above them that can see it in, you know, maybe 2,800 feet, maybe 2,900 feet. There's hedgerows of areas that maybe they cut the trees, but the stumps remain behind. They keep sprouting back. There's always something left behind. Not always, but usually there is. Some places are pasture. Some places are actually plowed for crops, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a factor for sure. But in any case, my point there is that, yeah, that's our training as foresters. But yeah, it's mostly site conditions. And don't get me wrong, site conditions are huge. But so are cultural influences.
Right, and that's what's left out.
That's what's left out. It's just being undervalued. And I think that's the point of Omar. Omar Stewart says, yeah, no, plants are definitely influenced by the site. But almost, in some cases, the tipping point or the just as important or relevant is what the humans are doing or not doing. So that's what I'm saying. So, where are we? Significance of fire. So, according to Stewart, fire isn't mentioned, at least in any real significant way, in this climax state or sequence. It's just not mentioned. To Stewart, the Native Americans burned wherever they could, whenever they could. I agree with him. The more I learn about fire and looking at tree species, about where I live, say in Sampsonville, the places where I find the most trees that really don't like fire are in either poorly drained sites or really, like, really far and remote from larger valleys, north-facing sites that, again, less humans, less land use. I'll give you an example, like Sampsonville, where I live, a lot of hemlock. But hemlock doesn't like poorly drained sites, but it will grow there. You know, really rocky, kind of poorly drained, you'll find it. as soon as you go up an elevation to a little knoll that could be burned, you'll find pitch pine all of a sudden. Oak, hickory. I think they burn a lot more than maybe they gave, we give them credit for.
It makes sense. I mean, you're not far from the Hudson River Valley, and the valleys themselves in your area are just broad-based, huge, wide, you know, easily livable.
Yeah, absolutely. Just about, he thinks, just about everywhere they probably burned. Okay, this is his opinion. And the people who write the foreword for this book, who are other researchers, they don't believe it either. They don't believe that they burned as much. I read their foreword, and they're like, yeah, I don't know. I don't think humans probably burn as much as he thinks. But Omer Story uses references from other academics, explorers, researchers. He uses data from trees, like the Yosemite I'll talk about later on. Fire scars. It's in the wood. You can tell when, you can get a frequency of how long they're burning, and you can kind of get an acreage too by seeing how many trees have that fire scar and when. Observations on comparisons of prior vegetation versus present vegetation in any given area. Now, he's going to talk prairies mostly here, right? What was once prairie now has trees.
Mm-hmm.
If Omer Story is wrong, he says this over and over again, if I'm wrong, why did it grow back with trees? Why is the Midwest growing back with trees once fire's eliminated?
Right.
And then he gets into the railroads, which I'm going to talk separately about. That's the coolest thing. That's your control. That's your study right there. That, to me, served as the most evidence to prove his point. But anyway, he also interviews Native Americans as well. But observations and comparisons of prior vegetation versus present. This study's been done, to me, in the Shangham Ridge of Ulster County. My friend there, who used to write books about fire on the Shangham Ridge, he has photos of his same campsite and places where even as early as the 1980s, as recent as the 1980s, the pitch pine was so much more dominant. There was so much less sassafras, red maple, and other vegetation. You could see. And since fire suppression has occurred, it's so grown up. Anecdotally, I've talked to blueberry pickers on the ridge. They used to burn it every 1 to 3 years, fire frequency, to produce more blueberries. The guy says we used to pick about 90 quarts of blueberries in a day, low bush blueberry. Low bush, no high bush. Now you'd be lucky, you know, get maybe a few gallons. All that oak, maple started growing in. We know there's less fires now in the Shangham Ridge than there used to be, just by looking at its vegetation. The pitch pine was so much more dominant before, in probably the late 1800s, because some of those trees date back to then, than it is today. We're losing the pitch pine. We're losing the low bush blueberry. Oak is coming in. So just as an aside, I can see that today. I think at one time, just a guess now, I bet you there's way more mountain laurel here around the Papatin Reservoir. People around here are romantic about mountain laurel. Like, wow, mountain laurel. I'm like, big deal. This freaking mountain laurel everywhere.
We get asked about it all the time over this direction.
I think at one time there probably was a lot, but it got shaded out and aged out. Now, mountain laurel needs like a 25 to 50 year or plus fire return. So if you don't get that, it's going away.
Right.
All right. Where you see a ton of mountain laurel, the most is in, you know, parts of Sullivan County where fire used to be very prevalent, like Forestburg, stuff like that, that craggy area, rocky area, and the Schwanck Ridge where humans are just burning it from every side. So, I don't know. What do you think?
Making a lot of good points. There's no doubt.
Well, so... What we'll go in next is, I mean, I don't want to summarize the whole book, but I'm just going to go through the book on things that stood out to me that I underlined. And if you're just tuning in, we'll take a break. We're talking about Omer Story's Forgotten Fires. He was an anthropologist and author, wrote this great book. It was, I think, ahead of its time. And the full title is, if I could find it, I always forget what it is. Oh, yeah, Forgotten Fires, Native Americans and the Transient Wilderness. He was again, an author and anthropologist at the University of Colorado at Boulder, retired in 1973. And we'll go through the book and just, you know, go under underlines up next. Supertramp. What a name. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Omar Stewart's Forgotten Fires, a book written in the 1950s. And let's talk about some of the things that I underlined in the book. So first of all, these prairies. Where did they go, right? It is known that prairies were once far more abundant prior to settlement. And these are beautiful places. I mean, just, you know, when the settlers first saw this, it was like, wow, I'm going to have to clear this stuff.
I mean, the prairies, talk about, you know, an oasis for game. I've visited them a couple times driving out west. I've hunted them. It seems desolate, but it's game rich and full of wildlife.
Because grazers need grass.
Not just, yeah, grazers.
Part, right?
There's just everything's out there. There's pronghorn antelope, bighorn sheep, deer.
Buffalo.
Buffalo, jackrabbit, prairie chicken, sharp-tail grouse.
Yeah.
It's just full of wildlife.
To the Native Americans, it seems like buffalo is a big deal.
Yeah.
As an understatement.
Right.
Buffalo, New York. I don't know. So these prairies were huge. There was a prairie peninsula, not just in the Midwest. We think of prairies, right? We think of, like, what, Iowa? We think of South Dakotas.
West, yeah. I mean, once you get past the Missouri River, Mississippi River, depending on how far north or south you're going, is when you're going to pick up prairies. But, Nebraska along I-80, South Dakota around I-90, when you're heading west. Anything west of the Platte River.
He thinks the prairies stretched, although it was a prairie peninsula, into Wisconsin, right? Oak savannas, really wide spacing, but even prairies stretching into New York State, maybe into the Mohawk. You could see that almost into New England. Prairies in Long Island.
Wow.
I mean, he's talking about prairies going in the southeast in every which direction.
Yeah, well, the book I last read, I brought up on the show not too long ago, The Long Hunters, they talked about in the book in Kentucky. It's not a state that you would think of to go find prairie now.
Yeah. A lot of prairie, okay? But how do you know there's prairie in Long Island? Because, no one talks about that. There's species, grass species, that he keeps talking about that are legacy of that.
Mm-hmm.
That only occur in prairies, apparently. I could see that. I mean, Long Island is, like, a perfect place for humans to live. You know, it's this peninsula jutting out into the ocean.
Right.
Full of fish game.
Right.
Fish. It has naturally occurring springs. Now you have freshwater fish.
Mild climate
compared to its surroundings. And then it's fairly flat. It's just perfect for humans. So I could see how. So wherever Native Americans were the most is where they really went to town on making prairies for those large herbivores that they would hunt. They would use fire, man, to just corral animals over and over again.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing stuff. They do circles. You know what's amazing I learned from his book is how often Native Americans would cite using fire for things that I never thought about, like grasshoppers. Yeah, they built circles all the time, especially out in the West.
Huh.
California and stuff. And just drive them into the center, and then they would have a smorgasbord
of grasshoppers. Huh, that makes
sense. They would eat. Yeah.
High protein stuff.
Because what would happen is as their wings would get singed, they couldn't fly away.
Yeah.
And then they were
well, done. I mean, we've quoted this paper many times, but Severinghouse, the game biologist in the 50s, he talks about Native Americans using fire to do deer drives between the Finger Lakes.
Yeah.
In that paper, the 7-mile drive, 7-mile fires lighting between each Finger Lake and driving deer north or south.
Right. That's amazing.
Imagine that.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that going on. So where did these prairies go? Stretching into Wisconsin and Ohio, places that are forested today. The impacts, according to Omar Stewart, are from the lack of prairies was from fire suppression and grazing. It's both. It's not just one or the other, although fire suppression, in many cases, just creates trees, as he will later talk about. But it's also grazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about it more. But grazing, grasses gain competitive advantage over trees and shrubs if they're burned, and they're not overgrazed. So when the Native Americans, which he doesn't get into because I don't know, he didn't talk about diseases much. Like Charles Mann, who we've had on the radio show, people say, well, how many Native Americans were there? He thinks probably 80-90% were killed by diseases. That's why there was such an impact from no Native Americans all of a sudden by the 1800s in many places, which
right.
is not burning. But as fires are not being lit anymore from people like Native Americans in the Midwest and everywhere else, people are moving in with cows. The cows are displacing the buffalo, but they're overgrazing it. So you would think, like, well, wouldn't the grasses just start growing and then maybe you get, you know, whether an accidental fire or lightning fires or whatever? Because once a grass fire on these tall grass prairies, not the short grass, but the tall grass prairies where it could carry fire, It would, I mean, it's, wow. Race. They said it was very impressive. Let's just say, Settlers, he just goes over all these accounts of Settlers being, it's one of the most impressive things you'll ever see is a prairie fire. But it's being grazed, okay? So if it's being overgrazed, you can't get the grasses. And if you don't get the tall grasses and it's browsed, grazed to the ground, it can't carry fire. So then what does grow is only things that the cows don't like to eat, like juniper, right? Maybe sage in the west, where that plant grows, wherever the hell that mesquite and sage is. But in the central part of the country, you're getting, like, you know, juniper and stuff that they don't like, maybe growing where the cows don't go or something like that, okay? Does that make sense so far?
I believe it. Like I said, where we went hunted in eastern Montana. Remember this spot? It was supposed to be good. You know, he researched. You don't know where you're going. I've never been there, but he researched places to go, and somebody wrote about it at one time, and it's supposed to be good. Man, it sucked. It really sucked. And I could see what you mean by other things coming in. It was overgrazed. You could tell. There's no grasses there at all. And what was abundant that forced us to leave was these little cacti, long needle stem, about medallion-sized cacti. The dog couldn't function. We were bird hunting, so we couldn't run the dog because she would step on them and get stuck through her feet. She'd try to pull them out and they get stuck through her lips.
Really?
And it was awful. So we were forced out of that spot. But you're right. It was overgrazed. That was the difference. No grass.
Yeah. This grass thing is what we're really going to harp on, prairies, to prove the point of the relevance of Native American burning before settlement. The forest, if we have time, we'll get into, but it's a little more complicated. But let's talk about his right-of-way experiment. So a right-of-way, you know, the train tracks are pushing into the west, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if what they would do is they would protect. They didn't want grazing next to the railroad tracks. They don't want animals, I guess, next to them. I don't know. So grazing is eliminated for a certain distance in the right-of-way of where the train tracks are. Okay, and this is the 1800s. And also, they would burn, prescribe burn in that right-of-way to keep the grass from growing too much so they wouldn't have a fire coming right up to the tracks because there's sparks all the time being
right
poured out. So they would do that as kind of like a you know, to put it in the black, basically, not build up fuels.
Right.
And this is where the prairie grasses were the healthiest. And account after account saying the best prairie grasses are, we don't know why, but they're right next to the train tracks always.
Hmm.
And it was basically reordering this recipe of what Native Americans are doing forever right next to the train tracks.
Frequent burns, yeah.
Right. Grazing is eliminated, and the grasses are growing because they're not being overgrazed, and they would burn once in a while. So only the grasses would gain a competitive advantage over the trees and shrubs, and they're very healthy. What's cool about this, he would say, is the vegetation. We always say, no, the soil is, you know, dictates the vegetation. He says, no, actually, the vegetation over time dictates the soil. I was like, what? Never thought about that because of my training. He's like, you know, the soil underneath these grasses of millennia that have been burned is like amazing, as the settlers would probably say, testify to. Awesome soil, right?
Right.
But is that all natural, or is it somewhat created by...
Just build up of organic material over time, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know how awesome the soil is underneath a wood pile that's had some bark breaking down over a few years.
Or right out... How many apple trees have we pruned that are right outside of an old cow barn that are phenomenally growing?
Yeah. Too fast. So, I already talked about this, the relic. So... Just to reiterate, the rights of ways experiment kind of proves to me that if you eliminate grazing, you have fire once in a while, it creates the prairies. Okay? It doesn't just go to, I don't know. What do you say? Like, it didn't just, it needed fire. It needed fire to occur. And there wasn't really many test plots back then because there was so much grazing going on. I mean, the whole Midwest was becoming full of cows. So how could you say that it was, you know, the prairie fires were natural or artificial? There was no test. That kind of proves it. I already talked about the relic colonies of prairie vegetation. Long Island found remnant grassland species there. The whole thing may have been a prairie. Who knows? So not just climate and soils, but fire determined vegetation. Okay, so fire as an ecological factor. This is really interesting. This will go to what to the Northeast a little bit. But in forest climates, where Native Americans were burning a lot, it retards the development and may result in scrub, but not prairie. So our area just wants to become trees.
Right.
Because of our climate. We get a lot of rainfall. In areas that are burned a lot, you get a lot of scrub. I totally understand that as a forester and my experience in Schwank Ridge. They've been burnt. That's the only area I can say where we burn a lot or there's a legacy of burning, and it's scrub vegetation up there. On Cherrytown Mountain and the Catskills even, scrub vegetation. That's where you find bear oak. Ashokan High Point, same thing. The Escarpment Range, Overlook Mountain near Woodstock, scrub vegetation. This totally makes sense to what he's saying. In prairie climates where there's less rainfall, so less than 40 inches of rain now, maybe less than 30, maybe less than 20, it doesn't go to scrub. It goes to prairie, okay? But people say, well, it wouldn't grow trees anyway. But is that true? That's what we'll get into. Is that true? Can that area not grow trees?
Oh, they can grow trees. You just talk to a farmer in Nebraska right now. That's a big topic in rangeland.
Areas we thought never could grow trees, turns out they grow trees. And they knew this in the 40s and 50s. So he did a huge study, page 210. Did a huge study, Plains Shelter Belt. They did it in Nebraska, among other states, in areas with very little rainfall. So Stewart believed that fire was driving force on why the prairies were treeless, not the climate. This was like sacrilege back then. They were like, this guy, I'm going to kill him. You know? Let me just back up a second. I mean, I think Clements, who, you know, talking about succession of plants, I think that's really valuable knowledge, by the way. I'm not discounting that. I just think he overlooked fire. That's all. So don't, you know, I'm not trying to be snobby about Clements back there. But so Stewart believed that fire was the driving force on why prairies were treeless, not the climate. Many didn't believe that trees could grow there. This project, the Plains Shelter Belt Project, demonstrated planting of trees in the plains to prove that they will grow. Yeah, they had a lot of success in Nebraska. And what he found was that once they started to grow, they would grow more because the trees would create more moisture.
Create their own climate.
Exactly. I was like, holy crap, that totally makes sense. Wow. I mean, we see that in a certain extent with maple, right?
I was about to say that. We see that in the Northeast, right?
Yeah, maple will produce more water because of the way water goes down its stem and retard fire.
And hold it to the forest floor with the way that their leaves lay flat on the surface.
Hell yeah, it's all coming together. Bryce Hanbury talked about that from the Forest Service. They have plots now under oak versus under maple. They create their own site conditions that are totally different. Drier versus wetter, like you just said with the leaves. So, I mean, that's just amazing. So anyway, as trees grew in, they created their different soil and moisture levels conducive to more trees. Mm-hmm. So that shelter belt just expanded. And you, what did you just say about juniper today?
It's a big topic in rangeland cattle areas that have been mismanaged. They're fighting juniper encroachment on what was prairie. That has other effects on wildlife. That's where I hear about it. I listen to some podcasts that talk about wildlife effects and problems all across the U.S. Ranchers are fighting it for they're losing valuable rangeland to graze on.
Amazing, right? Yeah.
And then so we see species, bird species mainly right now, which is just common, right? How many times have we heard of birds, you know, being the sounding alarm to other problems? You know, it's happened countless times in all sorts of different ecosystems. But yeah, the greater prairie chickens, one of them, or lesser, whichever one of them's threatened to become endangered
because of
loss of habitat, and this is one of the reasons.
There you go. I think the mistake is to say it's all because of the climate and climate change and to overlook the cultural changes.
Right.
But that's my opinion. That's Omer Stewart's opinion. Like I said, read the book. It really goes into it. So another thing is cultural differences between Native Americans and settlers and Americans. Big cultural difference. And I'm not saying one's better than another. They're just different. I mean, as Europeans came from an area that was didn't have as many trees because they used them, right? They used them for wood products, and charcoal was for smelting. So, you know, they used it to make metal, chemicals, barns to house livestock. Native Americans didn't have those.
Mm-hmm.
Wood is so important to the Europeans. To burn it, try and understand where they're coming from. To burn it would be sacrilege. Right? They just saw Native Americans just wasting timber. He goes over account over account where these people are like, they're burning again. Burning timber. You know what I mean? And you could see it. So anyway, this guy, this one guy, page 283, quotes this. This interview from the 1800s. We are trying to raise trees, whereas the Indians sought to raise forage. Because of overgrazing, because now their livestock starting to go in there, many of the best ranges have become unable to cope with the encroachment of brush. Right? That juniper crap. You've seen that in Delaware County. You ever see on the side of the reservoir where there's still those little junipers growing?
Mm-hmm.
Not like red cedar, but like they're like another kind of juniper. That's a legacy of overgrazing. But anyway, Indian forestry, says, or frequent burning, is a type of fireproofing by the use of fire, and that it is the only type of forestry that should be practiced in the standing timber today. What he's saying is, as the fuels build up, and there's these large fires, the Native Americans are trying to reduce that. They never had big fires because they were always burning. Behold today's fuels, sagebrush, California. It's a big problem. It's because of our neglect and ignorance of fire, not because of the climate. I don't believe that for a second. They've been suppressing fires in California for a very long time. They were saying this even when I was in school. 20 years ago, they were saying, you know, California's due. The fuels are building up. This is what happens. Yellow poplar is growing in the Midwest today. You know, in prairies, what was once a prairie. Red maple and beech in the Northeast. That's another sign of fire suppression. We're running out of time here, but I'll talk about this Yosemite study. So let me just back up, though. Native Americans forage over trees. When he's talking about Indian forestry, the forage, I mean, Native Americans weren't building huge structures out of wood. They weren't building huge ships to get over the Atlantic Ocean. They weren't liming the soil with potash.
Mm-hmm.
They were liming the soil with burning. open woods burning or prairie fires. But more importantly, the forage that comes in after a grass fire a year or two later or less was so much better they found for buffalo. And even the ranchers were saying, man, you know, for some reason, our cows, it's like the best grazing land after we burn. So it was for the buffalo. That's where a lot of this comes from. And then there's so many accounts. He goes into the Northeast about how you could ride a horse through the woods of New York State, Pennsylvania, you name it. And that's because larger trees were more protected by fire just by the simple truth of they have thicker bark and a larger stem is harder to girdle by fire. And a ground fire will kill the pole-sized trees and a lot of the vegetation down below. So you could ride a horse like a park through a lot of our forests. I mean, that has been documented over and over again by testimony as people went through Kentucky and everything. It was easy. It's easier. Now, forget about it.
Right.
So this Yosemite study is interesting. Page 198. Studied the trees there, found that the older ones had signs of fire. Younger trees, less than 100 years, did not. So once the settlers come in, white man, whatever, those fire scars are eliminated on the younger, none of the younger trees are displaying any fire scars. Fire scars on 74 acres, for example, they investigated 221 times between 1454, the year 1454, and 1912, or one fire every 2 years. They're burning in Yosemite. They also show like pictures of the vegetation. What is it? Ponderosa pine? I forget. Just coming down the slopes and just growing. They showed that to me when I was at the University of Colorado at Boulder. You could see on the front range in Boulder, from showing from the 1940s, 50s, up until present day, that ponderosa pine just creeping down from the front range into the valley. It's not supposed to be burning that. You can see it creeping down. It's the opposite out there, as you go up, it gets more humid and rainfall.
Right.
But this was creeping down into the valley as they suppress fires. Big fires, though, coming, right? Colorado, if you keep doing that. But so the regularity, and this, he goes over that too to disprove that it was lightning. These fires were too regular from the fire scars. They're happening over widespread area despite differences in climate, rainfall, evaporation, soils. They're happening way too regular. There's way too much evidence that's homogenous throughout the landscape, and the scars and trees is too homogenous and uniform for it to be lightning. Because when they would study lightning, it's way too sporadic, and it happens in the same areas because the same areas keep getting struck by lightning, which makes sense if you think about that. You ever see the same like one tree? I was up on a mountain the other day on Slide Mountain Wilderness Area 2 days ago. There's one tree struck by lightning. There's a tree right next to it struck by lightning. You know what I mean? Like it's just they're exposed for whatever reason on the mountain. It's not
the way the storms roll over the top of the mountain or whatever. It's yeah. Just prone to being hit right there.
It's not as uniform with lightning. So he was kind of disproving that. That was all I had. I got through it. But anyway, this book is a really good book to read. I think it should be, again, required reading to see where we're at, why we're at where we are in environmentalism today. Why this, what I would call the myth of wilderness, has been so popular. Why we look at vegetation and say, it's because of site conditions. Yeah. Site conditions is a factor. A lot of it is cultural land use patterns of humans. And so it's Omar Stewart's book, Forgotten Fires, Native Americans in the Transient Wilderness. It is windy out there, man.
I hear it.
Oh, man, I'm going to have some buckets on the ground.
Yeah, so, I mean, that brings us to the last point. It's like, what is, you know, at what point in time is the point that's best?
Well, they do it with everything. You know, it's like we got to go back to some vegetation that's the best, or the climate, some temperature that we think is normal. Who the hell knows?
Who says and who knows?
You got me thinking about that, too. I'm like, well, I don't think we're ever going back to prairies like we had before. That's a different culture.
But understanding how they got there and preserving what we have, what we know, you know, maybe for some value, wildlife, ecological, whatever we deem, how do we return a specific area?
Yeah.
What got it to that point and how to keep it?
Yeah, and where we want to go. To know, first of all, what we're giving up, what the opportunity cost of suppressing versus not suppressing.
Right, that's probably the biggest one, is knowing what the opportunity cost is.
And, yeah, we can't really go forward unless we know our history on this one. And unfortunately, I don't think we do. I think these fires, unfortunately, are still forgotten. But, well, we'll try. That's all the time we got on From the Forest. And see you next week. Have a good one.
Good night, everyone.
The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name.
Then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town.